We would like to send out a special thanks to Anna Luisa for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Anna Luisa makes beautiful, sustainable jewelry at fair prices. For 10% off, go to shop.analuisa.com/cold and use the promo code COLD. Enjoy the show.
May 3rd, 2002, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 7-year-old Alexis Patterson is walked to school by her stepfather, who claims that he last sees her crossing the street and heading in the direction of the school playground. Even though numerous students report seeing Alexis crying on the playground that day, she never attends any of her classes and is eventually reported missing. Over the years, investigators explore a number of potential leads and even direct some suspicion towards Alexis's family, but there are no conclusive answers about what happened to her, and after that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be profiling a missing children's case about a 7-year-old black girl, the 2002 disappearance of Alexis Patterson. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Michelle Matthews, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Michelle. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been holding for nearly 5 years now, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, I've received quite a few requests to cover the Alexis Patterson case on the podcast, and since we passed the 20th anniversary of her disappearance earlier this month, and her story has been brought back into the spotlight, I thought now would be an ideal time to do an episode. 2 decades ago, Alexis was walked to school by her stepfather before they went their separate ways, but she never attended any of her classes and vanished without a trace. If you go to the Wikipedia page for Missing White Woman Syndrome, you'll see Alexis Patterson's name listed on a chart titled Missing Persons Who Did Not Receive Comparable Media Attention, alongside another prominent victim. While Alexis's disappearance did garner a decent amount of coverage from the local media, it did not receive all that much national exposure, as only 1 month later, 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart was abducted from her home in Salt Lake City, Utah. Needless to say, that case would dominate the headlines for the next year, so Alexis's story pretty much got lost in the shuffle. On the surface, Alexis's disappearance would also appear to be an abduction, as some of her fellow classmates reported seeing her crying on the school playground on the morning she disappeared. However, since Alexis's stepfather had a history of criminal activity, there has been suspicion that a story about walking Alexis to school that morning is not true, and her family might know more than they've let on. One of the most frustrating aspects of researching this case has been finding contradictory information about certain details which leave one unsure about what to think, so we're going to address these issues on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the disappearance of Alexis Patterson. Our story begins in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 2002, and our central figure is 7-year-old Alexis Patterson. Alexis lives with her mother and stepfather, Ayana and Laurent Bourgeois, as well as her 6-month-old half-sister, Dysoni, and her stepbrother, Yoni, Laurent's son from her previous relationship. Ayana gave birth to Alexis only 2 weeks after her 16th birthday, and Alexis's biological father, Kenya Campbell, was not a major part of her life, as Ayana began a relationship with Laron when Alexis was only 3 months old. Alexis is currently a first-grade student at High Mount Boulevard School, which is located on West Garfield Avenue, less than one block away from her family's residence. Sometime between 7:40 and 8 a.m. on the morning of Friday, May the 3rd, Laron claimed that he walked Alexis to school, and when they arrived at the intersection of West Garfield Avenue and North 49th Street, he guided his stepdaughter halfway across the street before handing her off to a crossing guard. Laron said that he last saw Alexis heading towards the direction of the school playground before he turned around and walked back home. Later that afternoon, Alexis did not return to her residence at her scheduled time between 2:50 and 3 p.m., so Ayana walked down to the school to check on her. She was soon surprised to discover that Alexis did not attend any classes that day and had been marked absent, which was very out of character for her since she was a solid student who got good grades and had a perfect attendance record up until that point. The school would later face criticism for not informing Alexis's family about her absence much sooner, but they said they had a policy to only call parents if a student had been absent for 2 days in a row. Regardless, since Alexis's whereabouts could not be accounted for, Ayana contacted the Milwaukee Police Department to report her daughter missing. The police were initially inclined to believe that Alexis might have run away voluntarily since she had a big argument with her family on the morning she disappeared. Each student in Alexis's class was assigned a specific day to bring in treats for their classmates, and Alexis was scheduled to bring them cupcakes on May the 3rd, which she had picked out at a store the previous evening. However, because Alexis did not properly complete her homework assignment and lied about it, her mother and stepfather told her she would not be allowed to take the cupcakes to school, causing her to become angry and upset. Even though no one remembered seeing Alexis inside the school on May the 3rd, there were a number of students who reported seeing her crying on the school playground that day. Curiously, while some of them said they saw her there in the morning before classes began, others recalled seeing her in the afternoon after classes ended sometime between 3 and 5 p.m. When Alexis failed to resurface, the Milwaukee Police Department and the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office combined together for a large joint search effort, which also involved hundreds of civilian volunteers. Thousands of flyers were handed out, and a command post was set up in Washington Park, 10 blocks from where Alexis was last seen, but no trace of her could be found. There was concern that Alexis had been the victim of an abduction, as 2 weeks earlier, High Mount Boulevard School sent out letters to all of their students' families to warn them about an unidentified man who had attempted to abduct a little boy near the school. 1 week before Alexis went missing, a teacher spotted Alexis speaking to an unknown woman at the back of the school, and when her mother was informed about it, Ayana lectured Alexis about the dangers of talking to strangers. In spite of this, Alexis was seen talking to the same woman only 2 days later, and as far as I can tell, this woman was never identified. In addition, a number of Alexis's classmates reported that they had seen a red truck with dark tinted windows parked near the school throughout the week. They found the presence of the truck to be suspicious, since it never picked anyone up or dropped anyone off, and none of the students recognized who it might have belonged to. It's also been reported that the red truck was seen hanging around the school on the same morning Alexis disappeared, but it would not be seen in the area again after she went missing. Investigators started placing some focus on Alexis's family. Her biological father, Kenya Campbell, had a history of legal problems and had recently been arrested for repeatedly driving with a revoked license. However, since Kenya was still in jail on the date Alexis went missing and did not get released until 3 days later, he was not considered to be a suspect in her disappearance. Alexis's stepfather, Laron, also had a criminal history, as he had previously served 2 years in prison on a drug conviction, and October 28, 1994, Laron was the getaway driver for a bank robbery in Glendale, which went horribly wrong. A Glendale police officer named Ronald Head Bonney was killed after he was shot 5 times by Laron's accomplice, Booker Shipp III, but Laron was granted immunity in exchange for his testimony against Shipp, who received a life sentence for the crime. On May the 9th, the local media reported that Laron and Ayana were both questioned extensively for over 10 hours and took polygraph tests, but while Ayana passed, Laron did not. Laron supposedly failed on his answers to key questions, though it's never been revealed what the questions were, but Laron maintained that the police never told him he failed the test and assumed that the results would be kept confidential. So it took him by complete surprise when he learned that they were leaked to the media and published in the newspapers. Laurent and Ayanna were unhappy that investigators focused so much attention on them rather than exploring other leads, but it wasn't long before the authorities publicly announced that Alexis had disappeared under suspicious circumstances, and they had upgraded the search for her from a missing persons case to a criminal investigation. On May the 30th, it was announced that a 22-year-old Waukesha man named Brian T. Werner had been arrested for distributing racist flyers about the case. The flyers asked why any white person should care about the disappearance of a black girl like Alexis Patterson, and they would be left around various locations in Milwaukee, including America's Black Holocaust Museum. Werner was a known white supremacist, but the authorities ultimately decided to release him from custody after it was determined that his hateful comments were protected by the First Amendment Free Speech Clause. They also found nothing to indicate that Werner had any knowledge or involvement in Alexis's disappearance. In August, an anonymous caller contacted a Milwaukee TV station and claimed that Alexis's remains had been disposed of in the Milwaukee River near Estabrook Park, but even though divers extensively searched the water, they found nothing. Following her daughter's disappearance, Ayanna sunk into a deep depression and could barely leave the house, so her friends and relatives were forced to stop by to help her care for her infant daughter, Dysoni. By the end of the year, the family would move out of their residence to an undisclosed location because they said they had become overwhelmed by all the attention the case was bringing them. On April the 15th, 2003, the relationship between Ayanna and Laurent would completely fall apart after a domestic dispute took place and Laurent was arrested and charged with battery and disorderly conduct. According to Ayanna, Laurent did very little to comfort her after Alexis went missing, and he had become abusive and controlling. Laurent's arrest came about after Ayanna received a page from an unknown number, causing Laurent to go into a jealous rage where he beat Ayanna and pulled out a knife and threatened to kill her. Ayanna also accused Laurent of selling drugs and pimping out several women, but while the charges against him were ultimately dropped, their marriage would end in divorce. In May of 2004, the authorities received a tip from a convicted prisoner that Alexis's remains had been buried in the southern United States, but even though a vacant house in Baton Rouge, Louisiana was searched, it turned up empty. There would not be any significant developments in the investigation for the next few years, but in 2009, the case was assigned to the Milwaukee Police Department's newly formed Cold Case Unit. They proceeded to re-interview around 65 witnesses who had reported having seen Alexis walking to school or hanging around the playground on the morning she went missing, and some of them even acknowledged that they may have misremembered the date and did not actually see Alexis on May the 3rd, 2002. In 2012, on the 10-year anniversary of the disappearance, the mayor of Milwaukee declared that May the 3rd would be Alexis Patterson Forget-Me-Not Day. By this point, Ayanna was still raising Alexis's younger sister, Dysoni, and had since given birth to another daughter named Ariana. Ayanna said that Alexis's disappearance had made her more protective of her other two children, as she would always drive them to and from school instead of letting them walk or take the bus. She also claimed that every single year on April the 4th, the family would celebrate Alexis's birthday and hold a party in her absence. The case would take a surprising turn in July of 2016, when investigators were contacted by a man named Josh, who lived in Bryan, Ohio, and expressed his belief that his ex-wife Lisa might be Alexis Patterson. The couple originally got married in 2009 and had a son together before they divorced 4 years later, but Josh said that Lisa told him she had no memory of her childhood prior to her 10th birthday and did not own any photographs or mementos from that period of her life. When Josh came across an age-progressed composite photo of Alexis Patterson on the internet, he thought she bore a striking resemblance to his ex-wife. In addition, Josh said that Lisa and Alexis had a number of physical similarities, including a mole above her left eye, a scar under her right eye, a bump on her pinky finger, and a birthmark in the same place. Josh was so certain they were the same person that he even took his son to Milwaukee to meet Ayanna and introduced her as the boy's grandmother. Well, right from the outset, investigators were skeptical that Lisa was Alexis, because the timeline would have meant she was only 14 years old at the time she married Josh. When they tracked Lisa down and interviewed her, she maintained that she was 28 years old, not 21, like Alexis would have been at this point, and Lisa also had a 10-year-old daughter from a previous relationship. She also provided documentation to confirm her identity, including a passport, green card, and birth certificate, which showed that she was originally born in Belize in 1988. After an Ohio police officer swabbed Lisa's cheek to obtain a DNA sample, it was sent to the Milwaukee PD via FedEx, and after it was compared to Alexis's DNA profile at the Wisconsin State Crime Laboratories, the results showed that Lisa was not a match. In spite of this, Ayanna still openly expressed her belief that Lisa was Alexis, as she believed that they had way too many physical similarities not to be the same person, and wondered if, due to issues with the chain of custody, the DNA samples may have been contaminated or tampered with. She also claimed that instead of using her own DNA to make the comparison, they took a sample from a 14-year-old toothbrush, which may not have actually been used by Alexis at all, or contained traces of her DNA. While Ayanna has asked the authorities to perform a second test with a sample of her own DNA, her requests have always been denied. As for Laurent Bourgeois, he continued to run into legal troubles over the years, which included a 4.5-year stint in a state prison on felony heroin dealing charges. On January the 19th, 2021, Laurent and his current wife, Michelle Bourgeois, were both found dead inside their residence. Laurent was 52 at the time, and both deaths were believed to be the result of a drug overdose. Following Laurent's death, Steve Spingola, a retired lieutenant detective from the Milwaukee Police Department who once headed the investigation into Alexis's disappearance, made a surprising statement to the media. Spingola openly questioned Laurent's original story about walking Alexis to school, stating, quote, "That was the narrative since she went missing in 2002, and it's completely false. He never walked her to school that day. In fact, he never walked her to school, period. I think one of the people that could have provided the key answers died yesterday. That's the bottom line. Everyone overwhelmingly in law enforcement has thought that Laurent and Ayanna are involved in this case. The question is, what happened to Alexis?" End quote. It seems like opinions are divided about whether Alexis was the victim of a stranger abduction or if her family was complicit in her disappearance, and officially, her mother and stepfather have never been ruled out as suspects. But after 2 decades, Alexis Patterson continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to send out a special thanks to Anna Luisa, as we are very excited to have them now supporting The Trail Went Cold. This is a brand worth discussing because Anna Luisa produces high-quality, unique, and affordable jewelry such as earrings, necklaces, and rings, but because their pieces are 100% carbon neutral and 100% water neutral from packing to products, they always ensure to keep the planet in mind. With prices starting as low as $39, Anna Luisa has a large selection in which to shop for yourself or find the perfect gift for someone else, and they always release new jewelry collections every Friday. When Anna Luisa started supporting our show, they let me pick out some pieces, and I ordered a gold initial necklace with the letter R on it, and a gold nameplate necklace which read thank you. And of course, ever since then, I've proudly been wearing the R necklace, which looks great on me, and I gifted the thank you necklace to someone who greatly appreciated it. Even though Mother's Day took place earlier this month, it's never too early to plan for Mother's Day next year, and Anna Luisa Jewelry would make an ideal gift, not just for Mother's Day, but for holidays, birthdays, and other special occasions. And I'm pleased to say that we have an Anna Luisa deal for you, where you can go treat yourself or your loved ones by using our specialized promo code, COLD, to get 10% off. Anna Luisa is a terrific brand which makes a beautiful, sustainable jewelry, and I cannot recommend them enough. So to get 10% off, go to shop.analuisa.com/cold and use the promo code COLD. Once again, that's shop.analuisa.com/cold and the promo code is COLD. Thank you and enjoy the rest of this episode. So when we passed the 20th anniversary of Alexis's disappearance earlier this month, a lot of new articles were published about the case, and a good chunk of them compared the coverage her story received in comparison with Elizabeth Smart. And some of these articles had very clickbaity headlines such as, quote, "Two girls vanished, the media told us about one of them," or, quote, "Alexis Patterson has been missing since 2002, odds are you don't know her story." Well, that is a bit of an exaggeration, since Alexis's disappearance did receive ample coverage in the Wisconsin media and was a pretty big story in Milwaukee, and they even featured her on an episode of America's Most Wanted shortly after she went missing. But as far as national coverage, it is true that Alexis did not get all that much, especially after Elizabeth Smart's story started dominating the headlines. As a refresher, Elizabeth was 14 years old at the time and was abducted from her bedroom at her home in Salt Lake City, Utah on June the 5th, 2002. And of course, this turned out to be one of those very rare missing children's cases with a happy ending, as Elizabeth was held in captivity for 9 months and recovered alive in March of 2003, and her two captors were brought to justice. Now, even back then, a number of articles were published about the disparity in media coverage between Elizabeth Smart, who was an upper-class white girl, and victims like Alexis Patterson, who hailed from a rather low-income black family. That's not to say that Elizabeth's disappearance didn't deserve all the coverage it got, but would things have turned out differently if Alexis's story got more attention from the media? I mean, the reason Elizabeth was rescued was because someone recognized her face from all the press coverage, though in this particular case, we really have no idea how long Alexis lived after she was last seen. I guess the ironic thing is that whenever the media publishes a story about missing white woman syndrome and draws a comparison between two cases involving white victims and persons of color, the case involving the victim of color winds up getting extra attention by default. So at the very least, Alexis's disappearance has managed to consistently remain in the spotlight these past two decades and has not been forgotten. It sounds like Alexis was a pretty good kid overall, as she received good grades in school and had a perfect attendance record, but I'm sure the fact that she hailed from a family where both her birth father, Kenya Campbell, and her stepfather, Laurent Bourgeois, had criminal records might have clouded some people's perceptions. I have no idea if Kenya had any type of relationship with Alexis at this point in her life, but he was a very problematic figure, as he would later serve 4 years in prison for the manufacture and delivery of cocaine. And in 2013, Kenya was charged with 3 counts of felony child abuse and 1 count of child neglect for beating his 8-month-old daughter, and he wound up receiving an 18-year prison sentence. But as horrific as that sounds, Kenya was in jail on the day Alexis went missing, so there's no way he had any role in her disappearance. In the early stages of the investigation, no one from law enforcement publicly accused Alexis's family of being complicit in what happened to her, but I'm sure it didn't help public perception that stories about Laurent failing a polygraph test were published in the local press, even though polygraph results are not admissible as evidence. And of course, only 1 year later, Alexis's mother, Ayana, would accuse Laurent of being abusive and threatening to kill her, which eventually led to them getting divorced. It's worth noting that even though Laurent was not Alexis's biological father, he first became involved with Ayana when Alexis was only 3 months old, so he practically raised her from birth. And while Ayana did not hesitate to accuse Laurent of being violent towards her and doing some other unsavory things, such as selling drugs and pimping out women, I have never seen her state that Laurent was violent towards Alexis or accuse him of being responsible of her disappearance. I have to say that when I first learned about this case many years ago, I was initially not inclined to believe that Laurent played any role in what happened to her. In spite of his troubling history, it was reported that numerous witnesses saw Alexis alone on the school playground after Laurent walked her there, which, if accurate, would suggest that she was the victim of a stranger abduction. Once again, Laurent was never officially named as a suspect or person of interest by law enforcement, but there seems to have been a trend in recent years where former law enforcement officers have publicly voiced their suspicions about him. For example, there's former Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark, who held the position for 15 years. In May of 2017, only a few months before Clark resigned as sheriff, he did an interview with radio host John Mercure and openly expressed his belief that Laurent's story about walking Alexis to school was false and that he was personally responsible for his stepdaughter's disappearance. I previously mentioned that when Laurent died of a drug overdose in January of 2021, retired Lieutenant Detective Steve Spengola was quoted as saying that he did not believe Laurent ever walked Alexis to school, and virtually everyone in law enforcement has always thought that both Laurent and Ayana were involved in what happened. Now, if you go to the Web Sleuths forum, you'll find a thread about this case which features a post of a radio interview Spengola did in July of 2016 for the Milwaukee radio station News Talk 1130 WISN. Unfortunately, The actual audio of the interview is no longer available for download, but according to the Web Sleuth poster who shared it, Spengola stated that a cadaver dog was alerted to the basement of Alexis's home, as well as the trunk of her family's car. In addition, a call was placed from the residence to a hospital at 6 a.m. on the morning Alexis disappeared, but it only lasted 14 seconds before someone abruptly hung up. Now, these tidbits about the cadaver dog and the phone call have not been shared publicly by law enforcement and any other media outlet I've seen, but if accurate, they would present a compelling case for Alexis being killed inside her home. But once again, it's interesting how no one from law enforcement ever publicly accused LaRon or Ayana of being complicit in Alexis's disappearance while they were actively working the case, yet certain investigators have not hesitated to express their suspicions about the family when they're retired or about to retire. Almost immediately after Alexis went missing, LaRon and Ayana both expressed their frustrations about law enforcement focusing so much attention on them rather than pursuing other leads, and in recent years, Ayana has been a bit more open about addressing some of the accusations that have been made against her. I mentioned during this podcast intro that one of the most frustrating aspects of this case is the contradictory information about certain details. For many years, the narrative was that when LaRon and Ayana were given polygraph tests, LaRon failed on some of the answers to certain questions, but Ayana passed. However, in a 20th anniversary article about the case published in USA Today earlier this month, it was reported that Ayana had contacted the FBI about doing another DNA test to double-check if Lisa, the woman from Bryan, Ohio, was actually Alexis. Well, Ayana tape-recorded the conversation she had with the agent she spoke to, and he told her that since she had failed her first polygraph, they wouldn't help her with any further DNA testing unless she took a second polygraph and passed. Ayana said she wouldn't take a second polygraph unless the FBI showed her the report about her first one, but they refused. Oddly, the agent also told Ayana that supervisors from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children would confirm with her that a polygraph was necessary, which wasn't true, since the center's long-term missing guide for law enforcement discusses reviewing past polygraph results, but not administering new tests. So perhaps the agent was intentionally lying to Ayana about the original polygraph results in order to gauge her reaction. Ayana also recorded a conversation she had with a Milwaukee cold case detective about conducting another DNA test, and he replied, quote, "If I went to Ohio and swabbed Lisa's mouth myself, if I do that, if I bring it back here and it's not a match, will you tell what really happened?" End quote. Okay, well, I can understand the suspicion about LaRon potentially being responsible for Alexis' disappearance. I have to say that if Ayana was also involved, she has been awfully proactive about keeping her daughter's story in the spotlight these past two decades. Ayana has appeared on a number of TV shows and given a lot of interviews to spread awareness about the case. She recently held an event to commemorate the 20th anniversary of Alexis' disappearance, though her family admitted that they currently have no communication with the authorities and do not trust them. I know that Ayana and LaRon moved out of their residence in the months after Alexis vanished, which might seem unusual, since parents of missing children will sometimes refuse to change their address or phone number for decades on the off chance their child might return someday. If you believe that something happened to Alexis inside that house, then her mother and stepfather's actions might seem suspicious, but they've always maintained that the massive attention they received, even from well-wishers who knocked on their door in order to offer their support and condolences, was just too much for them, so they had to change addresses. I guess the one thing about Ayana which might come across as odd is her insistence that the results of the DNA testing were wrong, and that this woman named Lisa is her missing daughter. Even if you put credence into the idea that the DNA samples were contaminated, Lisa already had ample documentation to verify her identity, and the math just doesn't hold up. I've always found it odd that her ex-husband Josh was so convinced that Lisa was Alexis, because if that were the case, she technically only would have been 14 years old when they got married, which doesn't really reflect well on him. For some reason, Josh has also expressed skepticism about the DNA results, and spouted some odd conspiracy theories about how there's some sort of cover-up taking place and Lisa/Alexis is too frightened to reveal her true identity. If you search hard enough, you'll even find an online conspiracy theory about how Bryan, Ohio is a town made up of missing children who have no clue about their true identities. But Lisa was reportedly very cooperative And while she was sympathetic towards Alexis's family, she continued to maintain that she was not a missing child and did not like the attention she received over the whole situation. If you believe that Ayana was complicit in Alexis's disappearance, you could construe that she is refusing to accept the DNA results in order to push forward a false narrative that points away from foul play. But I also think that Ayana's reaction might simply be born out of her desperately clinging onto the hope that her daughter is still alive. So let's just assume that Detective Spingola's claim about the 6 a.m. phone call from Alexis's residence to a hospital is accurate. This could indicate that Alexis was seriously injured that morning, possibly as the result of a violent outburst, since we know that Laurent got arrested in a domestic dispute 1 year later. While Ayana or Laurent, or both of them, may have briefly attempted to phone the hospital to seek medical attention, they ultimately thought the better of it and hung up after only 14 seconds. If the hit from the cadaver dog in the trunk of the car was legitimate, then they may have decided to dispose of Alexis's body somewhere before Laurent fabricated a false story about walking her to school. They then waited until after 3 p.m. to feign concern about Alexis and report her missing, because that's when she normally would have returned home. It sounds like Laurent's alibi between 8 a.m. and 3 p.m. that day isn't anything concrete, as he claimed he was home the entire time and visited by his mother at one point, while Ayana took a friend of hers to get parts for a car and visit a mechanic. But of course, the biggest issue with this entire scenario about the family being responsible is that there were multiple eyewitnesses who reported seeing Alexis on the school playground after Laurent says he dropped her off. I'm going to talk more about this momentarily, but there are two more key details which often get overlooked, which I feel are worthy of discussion and only add to the frustration of getting contradictory information about this case from different sources. I have not seen this particular detail mentioned anywhere else, but on November the 20th, 2002, reporter Gary Wickert published an extensive article about the case in Greater Milwaukee Today, in which he stated that Alexis was accompanied to school not only by Laurent, but by her stepbrother, Yoni. As you recall, Yoni was Laurent's son from a previous relationship and was living with his father and Alexis at the time. Details about Yoni are very limited, though the article did state that he went back to live with his mother following Alexis's disappearance. While there are literally hundreds of other sources which repeat the story about Laurent walking Alexis to school, but this is the only one which says that Yoni was present, and I'd really be interested to know if he was interviewed by police to corroborate his father's story. Incidentally, Laurent was interviewed for the same Greater Milwaukee Today article, and he acknowledged that police brought cadaver dogs around the family's house searching for a body, which is the only time I've seen this information corroborated outside of Detective Spingola's radio interview. But the second key detail about that morning, which has been mentioned by multiple sources, is Laurent's claim that he guided Alexis halfway across the street and handed her off to a crossing guard before they went their separate ways. This crossing guard still got mentioned in a recent 20th anniversary article about this case, but their name has never been released publicly, and I have no idea if they ever corroborated Laurent's story. You see, one of the biggest issues with the sightings of Alexis on the playground is that these witnesses were children whose memories may have been faulty, but the crossing guard was presumably an adult, and it should have been very easy for this person to verify if Alexis walked towards the school that morning with Laurent. Yet I've been unable to find a conclusive answer to this whole situation, which has only left me scratching my head. One thing we can be pretty certain about is that Alexis never actually entered the school that day, since no witnesses recalled seeing her inside the building. But are the sightings of her on the playground reliable? Well, I don't put much stock into the witnesses who said they saw Alexis there after school ended between 3 and 5 p.m., as it makes no sense for her to take off and skip classes all day before returning to the school several hours later. But I certainly can't discount the sightings of Alexis which took place in the morning before school started, especially since she was reported to be crying. The story goes that Alexis was supposed to bring cupcakes for her class that day, but her mother and stepfather would not allow her to do so because she didn't complete her homework properly. As someone who was known for being a good student, I could see Alexis feeling embarrassed if she was forced to break a promise to her fellow students, and it might have been the one thing which made her want to avoid attending class, even though she did have a perfect attendance record up until that point. So I can see a scenario where Alexis wandered away from the school and was abducted by someone, or an unknown third party noticed her crying on the playground and decided to take advantage of the situation by kidnapping her. Since it sounds like the witnesses who saw Alexis on the playground that morning were kids, there's been some question about whether their accounts are credible, as they could have easily mistaken Alexis for someone else, or actually saw her there on a previous occasion and got mixed up about the date. Indeed, when a number of eyewitnesses were re-interviewed in 2009, some of them acknowledged that they may have misremembered seeing Alexis walking to school or sitting on the playground on that particular day. But on the other hand, there is evidence to suggest that a predator might have been hanging around the school during this time period. Remember, 2 weeks before Alexis went missing, parents received a letter warning them about a man who had attempted to abduct a boy, and as far as I can tell, this man was never caught or identified. We have reports of a suspicious-looking red truck being parked near the school in the week prior to Alexis's disappearance, which seemingly stopped showing up there after she vanished. And perhaps most importantly, we have a sighting of Alexis speaking to an unidentified woman at the back of the school that same week, and even though her mother warned her about the dangers of talking to strangers, Alexis was seen with the same woman again 2 days later. So this gives me the impression that Alexis was very outgoing when it came to speaking with adults, so if some opportunistic predator saw her crying alone on the playground that morning, they may have been able to exploit her vulnerability and convince her to accompany them somewhere. So we really only have two plausible scenarios here. Either Alexis walked to school and was abducted from the playground by an unknown party, or her family was responsible for her disappearance and fabricated the entire story. The issue is that if it was a stranger abduction, the perpetrator essentially got away with the perfect crime, as we have no real evidence that points to a suspect. I know that when LaRon was arrested after the domestic dispute 1 year later, Ayana openly accused him of selling drugs and pimping out women, which has led to uncorroborated rumors about a third potential scenario. What if LaRon did not physically harm Alexis, but either sold her or allowed her to be taken by someone because of a drug debt? Since LaRon did serve stints in prison on drug charges both before and after Alexis went missing, we know he was definitely involved in that sort of criminal activity, but I'm not sure if it's ever been officially confirmed if he was a pimp. If LaRon or Ayana were complicit in Alexis' disappearance, I'd really be curious to know what they did with her body. We had an anonymous caller claim that Alexis's remains could be found in the Milwaukee River, which never panned out, and also a tip from an inmate, which led to a search being performed of a vacant house in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The authorities have always been pretty tight-lipped about this particular tip, but in an interview he gave in 2013, LaRon acknowledged that he knew people in Baton Rouge, so I wonder if that had any significance to this lead. Obviously, LaRon was not a saint, but the way I see it, if the witnesses who saw Alexis on the school playground are accurate, that should absolve him of being a potential suspect. So are the investigators who have openly accused Alexis's family of involvement just suffering from a serious case of tunnel vision, or do they just have a lot of compelling evidence they've never released publicly, which points to an inside job? But when I see Ayana out there spreading awareness and giving emotional speeches about her missing daughter 20 years later, I have a hard time visualizing her being responsible for what happened, but since there's so much contradictory information about key details out there right now, I'm honestly not sure what to believe anymore. The sad thing is that if LaRon had some sort of involvement and was one of the only people who knew Alexis's fate, he took that secret to his grave when he died of a drug overdose last year. But for all we know, Alexis's family might be completely innocent, and the unknown person who abducted her has managed to stay off the radar for 2 decades. Even though I've received requests to put together an episode about Alexis's case for years, it was always my intention to hold off on covering it until the 20th anniversary, and I'm glad that I did, because some of the new information released in recent articles has made me look at this case in a different light, and the whole thing is a lot more complex than I expected. But whatever happened, I'm glad that Alexis's story is getting attention and is back in the spotlight again, and maybe one of these days we'll finally receive conclusive answers. There is a $10,000 reward being offered for information that leads to a resolution, so if you happen to have any information on the disappearance of Alexis Patterson, please call the Milwaukee Police Department at 414-935-7360. That's 414-935-7360. If you prefer to remain anonymous, you can also contact Milwaukee Crime Stoppers at 414-224-TIPS. That's 414-224-8477. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Michelle Matthews for narrating the opening of this week's episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released another joint bonus episode with my friend Charlie from the Crime Lines podcast, in which we discussed a very famous case from Unsolved Mysteries that wound up being solved, the murder of Shannon Moore by her husband, Dave Davis. In addition, I dropped an exclusive bonus episode for my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another classic case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1994 murder of Matt Flores. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Keith B. and Rebecca V. Thank you so much for your support. In addition, I wanted to mention that this coming Saturday, May the 28th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, we're going to be holding another Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathon, in which we screen classic segments from Unsolved Mysteries, and you can watch them and chat alongside myself and many of your fellow listeners. You can find the link to our screening room pinned to the top of our social media pages, and we'll also be including it in the show notes for this episode. Once again, our Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch takes place this coming Saturday, May the 28th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and we hope to see you there. I also just wanted to give a shout-out to the podcast Voices for Justice, hosted by Sarah Turney, which also released an episode earlier this month about the Alexis Patterson case in order to commemorate the 20th anniversary of her disappearance. It's one of the best victim-oriented true crime podcasts out there, and I highly recommend you check it out. Now, the reminder that in only 2 weeks, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing at CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on June the 11th and 12th. If you'd like to get a 10% discount on tickets to this event, please visit crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COLD22. Once again, that's crimecon.co.uk and the promo code is COLD22. Also, later this summer, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Weston Park Central Hotel in Dallas, Texas, on August the 27th and the 28th. Myself and many other prominent true crime podcasts will be in attendance, and there will be a bunch of panel sessions, discussions, and live episodes, so in order to purchase tickets, please visit the website truecrimepodcastfestival.com. That's truecrimepodcastfestival.com. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.